What I want to talk about today is very much related to what it is that's on the table before you. What's the name there, Paul, on the front of those cookies?
Hamantaschen.
Okay, Hamantaschen. Now, Hamantaschen, there's two words in there. What's the first word there in the front?
Sprinkle.
No, I mean...
Hamet.
Hamet. Okay, does that sound like a Bible character to you?
Haman.
We're going to learn about it. That's right, Haman. Taschen, I believe, is Yiddish for ears. So you're eating Haman's ears, which is a literal translation there of Hamantaschen. Now, why would we be eating Hamantaschen? Does anybody know what yesterday was, besides being a full moon on the lunar calendar?
It was the beginning of
Hanukkah.
Nope, no, Hanukkah's later.
No.
Yesterday was Purim. Okay, Purim is a Hebrew expression, Purim, and it means lots. So it is the Feast of Lots. We're going to learn a little bit more about that this morning. So that's your teaser before we dive into God's Word. Before I pass these out, I do have some notes for you. Let me just say this. Purim is a major Jewish holiday, and yesterday was Purim. It started 2 days ago at evening, and it went all the way until yesterday evening. So we're literally just coming off the heels of Purim. It is still celebrated today, and it rejoices in God's deliverance of the Jewish people from annihilation. And it is a biblical holiday. It's not just some fantastical thing created by rabbis much later. It is a biblical holiday. And as some of you know, as I mentioned, Purim just ended. It is a one-day celebration, except if you're in a walled city, then it's 2 days. There's only one walled city today in which the Jewish people celebrate for 2 days, and that's the old city of Jerusalem. Now, this event today is celebrated in a variety of ways. Here are just a few. The reading of the Megillah, or Megillah means scroll. So the reading of the scroll of Esther, which tells the story of Purim, and that's what we're going to do today. This recounts the miracle of Purim, and especially God's providential timing and his provisions in delivering his people. Also, you give gifts to poor people during this time, as is recorded in Scripture. You send gifts of food as well to people. And it is a festive celebration because you're celebrating God's deliverance, much like Passover. In fact, we're going to talk about some very intentional parallels between Passover and Purim, so that when we're celebrating Passover together just a couple weeks from now, you'll be able to draw even more deeply from these things. Unfortunately, today's festivities, if you go to a local synagogue, whether it's here in the States or in Israel, it is a commandment by the rabbis that you get drunk. So even kids are getting drunk at Purim. And the reason for that is that Haman is such a wicked character, as we'll see, that you want to be able to get to the place where you don't recognize between Haman and Esther, or between Haman and Mordecai. And of course, drinking is often associated with celebration in the world. And so for some reason, this has made its way into Judaism. It is the one time when you are commanded to get drunk in the Jewish New Year. It's very interesting. So without further ado.
Is that like through the Talmud or something?
That's through the Talmud. Okay. It's definitely not biblical. It is not biblical.
Is there anything about Mordecai?
Anything about Mordecai?
Yeah, in the festive.
In the festival, I mean, what happens at a Purim celebration is people dress up as the characters. Okay. And so oftentimes people dress up as righteous Mordecai and so forth. Yeah. Now, before we dive into Esther, let me just give us some background here. Morning, Mr. Kerlick.
Good morning, Levi.
Here's the background of Esther. The Jewish people are in exile in Persia on account of their sins. They reside in a huge Persian kingdom as just one of many different people groups. Esther was compiled during the Persian period, as is evident in the the 60 or so loan words that are in the original text, that are Persian loan words, coming over into the Hebrew text, indicating it was definitely written during that period. Also, the Hebrew of Esther is similar to other Persian books like Ezra and Nehemiah. So we see a lot of similarities in the Hebrew between those three books. Now, the author's purpose, when taking the rest of Scripture into account, it is clear that the overall purpose of the book is to highlight God's faithfulness. God's providence is found throughout the book as the expression of his covenant faithfulness according to the Abrahamic covenant. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. Now, there's a unique feature in the book of Esther. Anyone know what the unique feature of the book of Esther is?
So it's a female, it's a lead role.
God's name is never mentioned. Although his fingerprints are all over the book, his name is never mentioned. That's the only book in the Bible where that's the case. What the Moody Bible Commentary says is this: this omission of God's name should be understood as a device, like a literary device, meant to underscore God's faithfulness in fulfilling his promise to actually hide his face because of Israel's exile. So in Deuteronomy 31:17, God says that he would hide his face from Israel because of their sins of idolatry, and they'll be cast out of the land. The same is told in Isaiah 59:2. Moreover, excluding God's name intentionally is a literary strategy used to demonstrate that even when Israel forgot their God, God did not forget Israel. And he acted covertly through his providence to show his covenant faithfulness. So we are going to read through a large portion of this book, as is customary during this time for all the Jewish people. So Stephanie and I, by the way, those hamantashen are gifts of the Chabad Center, which is the missionary branch of Judaism, of Fort Lauderdale. Stephanie asked where the nearest bakery was last night when we went to the celebration, and the lady said, here you go, here's two boxes. So those come directly from the Jewish community on the other side of the state. Just take one, pass those along. It's all one there. And we have fill in the blanks as we go.
It's all the same. That all goes together.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yep, I did not have a stapler. Very good.
Just the whole thing?
Yeah, it's three pages there. So, we are going to just summarize chapter one. I'm going to summarize it for you, then we're going to start reading in chapter two. And I can tell you that in the synagogue, they read so fast, mainly because they're just trying to get through it. But they read the book of Esther twice during this time. Once on the eve of Purim, and then once yesterday, as Purim is ending. David, we just mentioned that yesterday was Purim, as you know. So, here's chapter one summarized for you. The Persian Empire was vast. It covered a swath of territory from India to Ethiopia. It was ruled by Xerxes from 486 to 465 BC, which is the setting of Esther. The empire's capital was Susa. And the huge empire was segmented into 127 different provinces, likely for administrative purposes. Xerxes is referred to in the Hebrew text as Ahasuerus, and in the Greek, in the Septuagint, as Artaxerxes, which is where we get our English translation, Xerxes. So your scriptures might either say Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes, or Xerxes. Those are all the same person. Just depends on what the translators took from. So, Xerxes decides to host a banquet. At the same time, his wife, Queen Vashti, decided to throw a banquet of her own for some women. As Xerxes was feeling the effects of wine, he ordered some of his eunuchs to bring the queen to his banquet so he could show her beauty to his guests. So he wants to show off his queen. However, she refuses. And you know what happens to a king when someone refuses his order, even if it's his wife. He became angry, and Queen Vashti was banned from his presence But we see right away God's hand is in this, because something's going to happen by God's providence. Let's go to chapter 2. If you have your scriptures, open it up, even if it's on your phone. We're going to read through this, and we're going to do about 20 to 25 minutes of straight reading here, and then we're going to finish with some really cool parallels. I may stop in between a little bit. But what you are doing here is a custom during Purim for over 2 millennia. So in a few weeks, we're going to be celebrating Passover, which is a custom for more than 3,500 years. This one doesn't have near that length, but it does have over 2,000 years of custom. Okay.
Are they reading in original
Hebrew? They're reading in Hebrew. They're reading from the Scroll of Esther. Mm-hmm. We're going to read in English.
Where are we at?
We are in Esther chapter 2.
Okay.
Esther, right after Nehemiah, right before Job. Because the book is a narrative, it's actually easy to just read through. There's not a lot of stuff to think and talk about necessarily. So, chapter 2. Sometime later, after Vashti had been banished, when King Xerxes' rage had cooled down, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what was decided against her. The king's personal attendant suggested, "Let a search be made for beautiful young women for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in each province of his kingdom, so that they may assemble all the beautiful young women to the harem at the fortress of Susa. Put them under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and give them the required beauty treatments. Then the young women who please the king will become queen instead of Vashti." This suggestion pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now in the fortress of Susa, there was a Jewish man named Mordecai, son of Yair, son of Shammai, son of Kish, a Benjamite. He'd been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the other captives when King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon took King Jeconiah of Judah into exile. Mordecai was the legal guardian of his cousin, Hadassah, that is, Esther, because she didn't have a father or a mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was extremely good-looking. When her father and mother died, Mordecai had adopted her as his own daughter. Now, just a quick note here. Hadassah is a Hebrew name. You go to Jerusalem and you'll see Hadassah Hospital. It means myrtle tree. However, Esther means star in Hebrew. Okay? And how you say that is pretty easy in Hebrew. Esther. It's very interesting that the Hebrew word for hidden or hide is astir. Very similar there. Esther, astir. And we talked about there's a lot of things hidden, including God's name. Esther, in fact, was hidden, placed right by God, as we'll see here, into the king's court to do God's bidding.
What translation are you using?
This is the HCSB. When the king's command and edict became public knowledge, and many young women gathered at the fortress of Susa under Hegai's care, Esther was also taken to the palace and placed under the care of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. The young woman pleased him and gained his favor so that he accelerated the process of the beauty treatments and special diet that she received. He assigned 7 hand-picked female servants to her from the palace and transferred her and her servants to the harem's best quarters. So right away, Esther is elevated in the king's eye. Now, Esther, verse 10, did not reveal her ethnic background or her birthplace. What is Esther's ethnic background? She's Jewish. She didn't reveal that because Mordecai had ordered her not to. Every day, Mordecai took a walk in front of the harem's courtyard to learn how Esther was doing and to see what was happening to her. Right? Mordecai being a good adopted father here, being a good uncle. During the year before each young woman's turn to go to King Ahasuerus, the harem regulation required her to receive receive beauty treatments with oil and myrrh for 6 months, and then with perfumes and cosmetics for another 6 months. When the young woman would go to the king, she was given whatever she requested to take with her from the harem to the palace. She'd go in the evening, and in the morning she would return to a second harem under the supervision of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch in charge of the concubines. She never went to the king again unless he desired her and summoned her by name. And we'll learn a little bit later, no one approached the king without the king's invitation. To do so without the king's permission, without his invitation, often meant death. Now, Esther was the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter. When her turn came to go to the king, she did not ask for anything except what Haggai, the king's trusted official in charge of the harem, suggested. Esther won approval in the sight of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal palace in the 10th month, the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other young women. He placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. The king held a great banquet for all of his officials and staff. It was Esther's banquet. He freed his provinces from tax payments and gave gifts worthy of the king's bounty. When the young women were assembled together for a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther still had not revealed her birthplace or her ethnic background as Mordecai had directed. She obeyed Mordecai's orders as she always had while he raised her. During those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bithan and Teresh, two eunuchs who guarded the king's entrance, became infuriated and planned to assassinate King Ahasuerus. When Mordecai learned of the plot, he reported it to Queen Esther, and she told the king on Mordecai's behalf. When the report was investigated and verified, both men were hanged on the gallows. This event was recorded in the historical king's presence. Now, you see you have two blanks there for chapter 2. Your first blank is this. God positioned Esther by placing her in the king's royal court. Your second blank, God positioned Mordecai by placing him at the city gate. And we are, what we're setting up for here is basically the defense against a Jewish genocide. And you'll see that. Chapter 3. After all this took place, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite. You could do an entire study on this guy, son of an Agagite. A long time ago, many centuries before this, Saul was supposed to take care of these folks. They were supposed to be completely wiped out of Israel, and they were not. Mm-hmm. And anytime something like that was supposed to happen that doesn't, it always comes back to bite us. It doesn't just go away. So, Haman is promoted. He's given a higher position than all the other officials. Verse 2, the entire royal staff at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman because the king had commanded this to be done for him. But Mordecai would not bow down or pay homage. Why wouldn't Mordecai bow down and pay homage?
The one true God wouldn't.
There's one true God, and Mordecai is faithful to that one true God, the God of Israel. The members of the royal staff at the king's gate asked Mordecai, why are you disobeying the king's command? Can you think of another faithful servant in Persia who disobeyed the king's command and would not bow down?
Daniel.
Exactly. When they had warned Mordecai day after day, and he still would not listen to them, they told Haman to see if Mordecai's actions would be tolerated, since he had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai was not bowing down or paying him homage, he was filled with rage. Probably one of the most narcissistic people in the Bible here, Haman. And when he learned of Mordecai's ethnic identity, right? So he learns that he's Jewish. Haman decided not to do away with Mordecai alone. Now, this is the epitome of anti-Semitism. When you take one Jewish person and you say, all Jewish people are like this guy. Or the epitome of really any kind of racism. When you see one person of a different ethnicity or a different color, and you attribute that to all people of that race or color. Verse 7. Let's go back to verse 6. What does he plan to do to all the Jewish people in the kingdom?
Destroy them.
Kill them. 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. That's probably a much larger area than Europe during the Holocaust.
I wonder if he was Hitler's brother.
Maybe he's a type of a Hitler, for sure. Verse 7. in the first month, the month of Nisan, in King Xerxes' 12th year, Pur, that is the lot. Now remember, I told you, Pur means lot. Purim means lots. Now, the Pur was cast, the lot was cast before Haman for each day and each month. Why is he doing this? What is this ritual? Well, we don't have time to get into all the background here. But the best guess is that this is a type of Zoroastrianism. It's an ancient Middle Eastern false religion that's still practiced in places like Iraq today. And one of their practices is to cast these lots and decide, the god decides, what's happening through the casting of these lots. So Haman, the pagan, the anti-Semite, is doing this. And it fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman informed King Ahasuerus, "Hey, king, there's one ethnic group scattered throughout the peoples in every province of your kingdom, yet living in isolation. Their laws are different from everyone else's, and they don't obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them." Right? "Don't tolerate the Jews, king. If the king approves, let an order be drawn up authorizing their destruction." And then look what the anti-Semite does. "I will pay 375 tons of silver to the accountants for deposit." He's going to use his own money to fund a genocide. That's how much hate is in his heart. So, verse 10. King Xerxes removes his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jewish people. Then the king told Haman, "The money and people are given to you to do as you see fit." Now, the king doesn't know what yet.
Esther.
Mordecai. He does not know that Esther is Jewish, and he loves Esther. The other thing he doesn't know at this point yet is that Mordecai has saved his life because he reported the assassination attempt, which ended up saving the king's life. And we know whose hand was moving to make all those things happen.
This is one of the examples of all things happen together for good, all things.
That's right. So, the royal scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. The order was given exactly as Haman commanded it. It was intended for the royal satraps, the governors of each province, and the officials of each ethnic group, and written for each province in its own script, and to each ethnic group in its own language. It was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the royal signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to each of the royal provinces telling the officials to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jewish people. Young, old, women, children. It's just like the Holocaust. Not only that, but to plunder their possessions on the single day, the 13th day of Adar, the 12th month. A copy of the text, issued as law throughout every province, was distributed to all the peoples so that they might get ready for that day. Can you imagine this? Being in a population, huge population, and you receive orders from the officials. Your governor sends you a letter. Your senator sends you a letter. "On this day, we're going to destroy the Jewish people living in your community." So it was issued. The couriers left, spurred on by royal command, and the law was issued from the fortress of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink while the city of Susa was in confusion. Right? Supposedly a large Jewish community there in Susa, the capital. Let's go chapter 3. You have a couple blanks there on your paper. Lots, or Purim, are cast by wicked Haman to determine a day of Jewish genocide.
And what was the date? The 12th of Adar? Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and Mordecai chooses faith, not fear. Mordecai chooses faith, not fear. Chapter 4. When Mordecai learned about all that had occurred, right, he gets this letter. He and his people are going to be killed. He tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went into the middle of the city and cried loudly and bitterly. He only went as far as the king's gate, since the law prohibited anyone wearing sackcloth from entering the king's gate. There was great mourning among the Jewish people in every province where the king's command and edict came. They fasted, wept, and lamented, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Esther's female servants and her eunuchs came and reported the news to her, and the queen was overcome with fear. She sent clothes for Mordecai to wear so he could take off his sackcloth, but he did not accept them. Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to her, and dispatched him to Mordecai to learn what he was doing and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened, as well as the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay the royal treasury for the slaughter of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa ordering their destruction, so that Hathach might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and command her to approach the king, implore his favor, and plead with him personally for her people. Hathach came and repeated Mordecai's request to Esther. So Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to tell Mordecai. So Esther replies to Mordecai here. Verse 11, all the royal officials and the people of the royal provinces know that one law applies to every man or woman who approaches the king in the inner courtyard and who has not been summoned, the death penalty. Only if the king extends the gold scepter will that person live. I've not been summoned to appear before the king for the last 30 days. So Esther's response was accorded to Mordecai. You see her concern here. Mordecai wants me to go visit the king. But Mordecai, don't you know, if I just go visit the king, there's a very great likelihood I'll be killed. So Mordecai then tells the messenger to reply to Esther. Verse 13. Don't you think, Esther, that you will escape the fate of all the Jews just because you're in the king's palace? If you keep silent at this time, liberation and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place, but you and your father's house will be destroyed. Who knows? Perhaps you've come to your royal position for such a time as this. Now, you've heard that phrase before, for such a time as this, right? It comes right from the Bible. And God has indeed placed Esther right in this position for such a time as this. So you have a couple blank spaces there on chapter 4. Mordecai recognizes that Esther has been placed in the royal court for such a time as this. You know, on a personal level, God has you right where you are for such a time as this. It may not be this exact day. That day might be coming.
Interesting when you read that, saying, Esther, do this. But if you don't do it, God picks up.
God raises him up
no matter what.
And why is it that Mordecai knew that? What is he basing that belief on?
He had faith.
He had faith. Faith in what exactly?
In the promises that God gave to Abraham.
Exactly. In the promises that God gave to Abraham. Mordecai, to your point, knew his scriptures. And God, he knows that God has promised. He will bless the seed of Abraham, and that Abraham will always have descendants. That there will never be a complete annihilation of the Jewish people.
The other side of that curse.
Yeah. He also knows the other side of the curse. Yeah, exactly. Your second blank there. Esther risks her life for her people. That's actually coming up in just a second. Chapter 5, on the third day, Esther dressed up in her royal clothes and stood in the inner courtyard of the palace facing
him.
I didn't finish 4. Verse 15?
No, 16.
So 15. Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. So she's made up her mind. Go assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa and fast for me. Good idea. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, day or night. I and my female servants will also fast in the same way. After that, I'll go to the king. Even if it's against the law, look at her response. If I perish, then I perish. She's resolved. She's made up her mind. So Mordecai went and did everything Esther had ordered him. And that's where we have Esther risks her life for her people. On the third day, Esther dressed up in her royal clothing and stood in the inner courtyard of the palace facing it. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the royal courtroom facing its entrance. As soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the courtyard, she won his approval. Praise God. As soon as the king saw Esther, so the king extended his gold scepter in his hand, and she approached and touched the tip of the scepter. What is it, Queen Esther? The king asked her. Whatever you want, even to half the kingdom, will be given to you. Wow. Yeah.
Is it who did that John the Baptist got killed? And I'll give you...
No.
Herod,
Oh, yeah. That was Herod's daughter. King Herod. And he said, I'll give you anything up to half my kingdom. And she said, John the Baptist's head on a plate. Yeah.
I wonder if that was just a culture, a thing that went through that give you half.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's a good question.
You know, again, there's a point here about prayer.
Yeah.
She knew that the custom was that she would die.
Yeah.
But she prayed.
But she prayed.
And she asked others to pray.
Yeah.
And when we really have a need, oh, there's power.
That's right.
Power in going to the Lord in prayer.
That's right. Amen. So, whatever you want, even up to half the kingdom, I'll give to you. Verse 4. If it pleases the king, Esther replied, may the king and Haman come today to the banquet I've prepared for them. Right, now, she wasn't dumb about this. She was smart. She was shrewd in a good way. And so was Mordecai by giving her advice. While drinking the wine, the king asked Esther, hey, whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you want, even to half the kingdom, will be done. Esther answered, this is my petition and my request. If the king approves of me, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and perform my request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet I'll prepare for them. Tomorrow, I'll do what the king has asked. That day, Haman left full of joy and in good spirits. But when Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate, and Mordecai did not rise and tremble in fear at his presence, Haman was filled with rage toward Mordecai. Yet Haman controlled himself and went home. He sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh to join him. Then Haman described for them his glorious wealth and his many sons. He told them all how the king had honored him and promoted him in rank over the other officials in the royal staff. What's more, Haman added, Queen Esther invited no one but me to join the king at the banquet she had prepared. I'm invited again tomorrow to join her with the king. Still, none of this satisfies me since I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate all the time. His wife Zeresh and all his friends told him, have them build a gallows 75 feet high. Ask the king in the morning to hang Mordecai on it. Then go to the banquet with the king and enjoy yourself. The advice pleased Haman, so he ordered the gallows to be constructed. So, chapter 5 blanks there. Esther requests a banquet. Haman builds the gallows. Chapter 6. That night, sleep escaped King Xerxes. So he ordered the book recording daily events to be brought and read to the king. What is he going to read in the book?
The account of how he was saved.
The account of how he was saved. They found the written report, verse 2, of how Mordecai had informed on Bigthana and Teresh, two eunuchs who guarded the king's entrance, when they planned to assassinate King Ahasuerus. The king inquired, what honor or special recognition has been given to this Mordecai for this act? The king's personal attendants replied, nothing's been done to him. The king asked, who's in the court? Now Haman was just entering the court to ask the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows, as he had prepared for. The king's attendants answered him, Haman is there, standing in the court. Have him enter, the king said. Haman entered, and the king asked him, Haman, what should be done for the man who the king wants to honor? Now, being a narcissist, who does Haman think he's talking about?
It's all about me.
Haman thought to himself, who is it the king would want to honor more than me? Haman told the king, for the man the king wants to honor, have them bring a royal garment that the king himself has worn and a horse the king himself has ridden, which has a royal diamond on its head. Put the garment and the horse under the charge of one of the king's most notable officials. Have them clothe the man the king wants to honor, parade him on the horse throughout the city square, and proclaim before him, this is what is done for the man the king wants to honor. The king told Haman, hurry and do just as you proposed. Take a garment and a horse for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Don't leave anything out that you've suggested. So Haman took the garment and the horse. He clothed Mordecai and paraded him through the city square, crying out before him. This would be perfect made for TV stuff.
Oh. Ideal.
Ideal. This is what must be done for the man the king wants to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman, overwhelmed, hurried off for home with his head covered. Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai is Jewish, and you've begun to fall before him, you won't overcome him because your downfall is certain. Again, they're taking this as an omen because of their pagan religion. While they were still speaking with him, the eunuchs of the king arrived and rushed Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. So, chapter 6 there, your two blanks. God's providential insomnia. Right? The king can't sleep, and he wants to read the historical record. Second, God's providential timing. Just as the king finished reading the account of Mordecai's saving, in walks Haman. Chapter 7, our last chapter that we're going to read, and then we're going to do some summarizing and talk about some parallels. The king and Haman came to feast with Esther, the queen. Once again, on the second day, while drinking wine, the king asked Esther, "Queen Esther, whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you seek, even to half my kingdom, will be done." Queen Esther answered, "If I have obtained favor from you, my king, and if the king is pleased, spare my life, this is my request, and spare my people, this is my desire. For my people and I have been sold out to destruction, death, and extermination. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept silent. Indeed, the trouble wouldn't be worth burdening the king." King Xerxes spoke up and asked Queen Esther, "Who is this? And where is the one who would devise such a scheme?" Esther answered, "The adversary and enemy is the evil Haman." By the way, who's at this party?
Haman.
Three people. This is kind of an awkward conversation, right? King, the evil, wicked Haman has devised this scheme. Haman stood terrified before the king and the queen. Angered by this, the king arose from where they were drinking wine and went to the palace garden. Haman remained to beg Queen Esther for his life because he realized the king was planning something terrible for him. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the house of drinking wine drinking, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. "Whoops!" The king exclaimed, "Would he actually violate the queen while I'm in the palace?" As soon as the statement left the king's mouth, Haman's face was covered. Harbona, one of the royal eunuchs, said, "Hey, king, there's a gallows 75 feet tall out here at Haman's house that he made for Mordecai, who gave the report that saved the king." The king commanded, "Hang him on it." They hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's anger subsided.
Quite a story.
Let me just give you the summary of chapters 8, 9, and 10, because we don't have time to read through them. Let me summarize them for you. Since Haman's edict to destroy all the Jewish people was issued with the authority of the signet ring, it could not be revoked according to Persian law. So it was out there. Everyone had read it. Therefore, Esther convinced the king to send another edict. This edict allowed the Jewish community to defend themselves against any wicked anti-Semites that still desired to carry out Haman's edict of Jewish genocide. So, you get this letter. Can you imagine any of your neighbors thinking, "Oh, good, phew, I don't have to kill the Jewish people"? Hopefully. But apparently, there were still quite a few anti-Semites. The Jewish people, in defending themselves, killed thousands who still wanted to slaughter them despite the edict of self-defense being there. Despite Haman's death, you still had enough people that hated the Israelites that they wanted them dead. And then the author concludes with an overview of the observance of Purim, which is where the Jewish people today get reading through it, giving gifts, celebrating, and so forth, and what we've done here today. So these are Haman's ears, and we eat this in celebration that at God's providence, he was hanged on the very gallows that he built to hang the righteous Mordecai, the Jewish man. Now let me give you some interesting parallels here between Passover and Purim, and I think you still have some blanks to fill out here. There is intentional parallelism that the author uses to connect this story to the Passover story. Both narratives tell of the comprehensive deliverance of the entire Jewish people set outside of the Promised Land. In both narratives, the deliverance comes through a specific Jewish individual strategically placed in the Gentile king's own family. Who was that character at the Passover? The Jewish person raised in the king's family? Moses. Who is it in this story?
Esther.
Esther. Both of them had an assistance from an immediate family member. Moses had?
Aaron.
Esther has?
Mordecai.
In both narratives, the key protagonist is initially hesitant to mediate the deliverance. Moses said what in hesitating?
I can't talk.
I can't talk, Lord. Surely there's someone else. Esther said what?
I can't talk.
I can't go into the king, essentially. I can't go into the king on my own. But both eventually resolved to follow through. In both narratives, the turning point from affliction to deliverance is initiated in the exact same month, apparently on the same day of that month. I.e., the decree in Esther was made on the 13th of Nisan, Passover Eve. Not a coincidence. In both narratives, the deliverance of the Jewish people results in the large-scale evangelism of Gentiles to faith. If you read the final few chapters there, which I would encourage you to do, the Jewish people defend themselves against all the horrible anti-Semites, and many Gentiles place their faith in the God of Israel. The same exact thing happened at the Passover. God's fame from what he did with the parting of the Red Sea spread to the nations, and Gentiles placed their true faith. We see that with Rahab the prostitute. Of all the feasts in the Hebrew Bible, these are the only two that commemorate past events of deliverance of the Jewish people. Passover and Purim are the only yearly feasts celebrated in the months of Nisan and Adar. Now, I don't have a board in here, but if I did, I would write.
There's one behind that thing there.
Well, I guess I really don't need it. Let me just tell you this. Nisan is the first month of the Hebrew calendar, Nisan 14. How does it begin for the Jewish people? Celebrating God's deliverance from Egypt. Adar, the last month of the Hebrew calendar. Purim, celebrating God's deliverance of the Jewish people. Passover, 14th of Nisan. Purim, 14th of Adar. We serve a very precise God who does not do these things on accident. These are bookends of God's calendar. Passover and Purim are the only yearly feasts that are celebrated on the 14th, actually. Thus linked, the two feasts may be seen as mirrored bookends occurring as they do on the same day in the first and last months. Opposite ends of Israelite biblical history in the Jewish canon, okay? Exodus in the Torah at the very beginning of the canon. Esther is placed in the Hebrew canon in the last few books. So they're bookends of history, of the Jewish history, of the Old Testament period, and their bookends of the canon. In this way, they call attention to the year-round, or hence circular, or unending, faithfulness of God toward the people he has sworn eternally to preserve. And that, my friends, is Esther and Purim.